The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 2, Section 1, continued.
Cassette 2, Side 2.
I am not in a state of mind to express my impressions in just a few words. I wouldn't want, yes, and I would likewise be ashamed, to permit myself banal praise of the remarkable energy of people who, while remaining vigilant and tireless sentinels of the revolution, are able, at the same time, to be remarkably bold creators of culture. On June the 23rd, Gorky left Solovki. Hardly had his steamer pulled away from the pier than they shot the boy. Oh, great interpreter of the human heart, great connoisseur of human beings, how could he have failed to take the boy along with him? And that is how faith in justice was instilled in the new generation. They try to tell us that up there on the summit, the chief of literature made excuses that he didn't want to publish praise of USLON. But how can that be, Alexei Maximovich, with bourgeois Europe looking on? But right now, right at this very moment, which is so dangerous and so complicated, and the camp regimen there, we'll change it. We'll change the camp regimen. And he did publish his statement, and it was republished over and over in the big free press, both our own and that of the West, in the name of the Falcon and Stormy Petrel, claiming it was nonsense to frighten people with Solovki, and that prisoners lived remarkably well there and were being well reformed. And, descending into his coffin, he gave his blessing to the archipelago. I used to ascribe Gorky's pitiful conduct after his return from Italy and right up to his death to his delusions and folly. But his recently published correspondence of the 20s provides a reason for explaining it on lesser grounds, material self-interest. In Sorrento, Gorky was astonished to discover that no world fame had accrued to him, nor money either. He had a whole palace full of servants. It became clear that both for money and to revive his fame, he had to return to the Soviet Union and accept all the attached conditions. He thereby became Yagoda's voluntary prisoner, and Stalin killed him to no purpose, out of excessive caution. Gorky would have sung hymns of praise to 1937, too. And as for the camp regimen, they kept their promise. The regimen was reformed. Now, in the 11th Punishment Company, they were kept standing for a week, packed against one another. A commission came to Solovki, and it wasn't a Salts commission either, but an investigative punitive commission. It delved into things, and, with the help of the local ISCH, came to understand that all the cruelties of the Solovetsky camp regime were the work of the white guards of the ACH, and of the aristocrats in general, and partly of the students, too, those very same students who since the past century had been setting St. Petersburg on fire. At this point, the silly, unsuccessful escape attempt of the insane Kozhevnikov, former minister of the Far Eastern Republic, together with Shepchinsky and Degtyaryov, the cowboy, was inflated into an enormous and fantastic plot by the White Guards, who were allegedly scheming to seize a steamship and sail away. And they began to make arrests, and even though no one confessed to such a plot, the case kept on growing, as did the arrests. They had set themselves a figure of 300, and they reached it. And on the night of October the 15th, 1929, having dispersed everyone and locked them up in quarters, the holy gates, ordinarily kept locked, were opened so as to shorten the route to the cemetery. They kept taking groups there the whole night long, and each group was accompanied by the desperate howling of the dog, Black, who had been tied up somewhere and who suspected that his master, Bagratuni, was being led off in each new group. The prisoners could count the number of groups being taken off by the number of periods of howling, but because of a strong wind, the shots themselves were less audible. This howling had such an impact on the executioners that the next day they shot not only Black, but also all the other dogs on account of Black. The executioners were the three fancy Dan junkies, plus the chief of the camp guard, Degtyaryov, and, no less, the chief of the cultural and educational section, Uspensky. The combination was only superficially astonishing. This Uspensky's biography is what is called typical, In other words, not the most common, but concentrating in itself the essence of the epoch. He was born the son of a priest, and that is what he was when the revolution caught up with him. What did he have to look forward to? Security questionnaires, restrictions, exile, persecution. And there is no possible way to erase this from one's record, no possible way to change one's father. But no, Uspensky discovered there was a way. He killed his own father, and declared to the authorities that he had done it out of class hatred. This was a healthy attitude, and almost not murder at all. He was given an easy sentence, and he immediately rose in the camp in the cultural and educational line of work, and was soon liberated. And here we come upon him as the free chief of the cultural and educational section, the KVCH, of Solovki. And as far as these executions are concerned, it is not known whether he volunteered or whether they suggested he reaffirm his class position. By night's end, at any rate, he was seen washing off the blood-soaked tops of his boots, one after the other, over a wash-basin. They were drunk and careless, and in the morning the enormous pit, only lightly covered over, was still stirring and moving. Throughout October and during November too, they brought additional groups from the mainland for execution. In one of them, Kurilko was shot. Somewhat later, the entire cemetery was levelled by the prisoners while a band played in the background. After those executions, the chief of SLON was replaced. Zarin came to replace Achmans, and it is considered that a new era of Solovetsky legality was thereby established. However, here is what it was like. In the summer of 1930, they brought to Solovki several dozen religious sectarians who rejected anything that came from Antichrist. They refused to accept any documents, including passports, and they refused to sign for anything or to handle any money. At their head was a grey-bearded old man of 80, blind and bearing a long staff. Every enlightened person could clearly see that these sectarians could never ever enter into socialism, because that required having a great deal to do with papers, and that therefore the best thing for them to do was to die. And so they sent them off to Malizayatsky Island, the smallest in the entire Solovetsky archipelago, sandy, unforested desert, containing a summer hut of the former monk fishermen. And they expressed willingness to give them 2 months' rations, the condition being that each one of the sectarians would have to sign for them on the invoice. Of course, they refused. At this point, the indefatigable Anna Skripnikova intervened. Notwithstanding her own youth and the youth of the Soviet government, she had already been arrested for the fourth time. She dashed back and forth between the accounting office, the worker signers, and the chief of the camp himself, who was engaged in putting into effect the humanitarian regimen. She first besought compassion for them, and after that she begged to be sent to the Zayatsky Islands with the sectarians as their clerk, undertaking the obligation of issuing food to them each day, and conducting all the bookkeeping formalities for them. And it would appear that this didn't conflict in any respect with the camp system, and the chiefs refused. "But they feed insane people without asking for signatures on receipts," Anna cried. Zarin only burst out laughing, and a woman worker signer replied, "Maybe those are Moscow's orders, we don't really know." Of course they were instructions from Moscow, for who else would have taken responsibility? And so they were sent off without food. 2 months later, exactly 2 months, because they were then to be asked to sign for their food for the next 2 months, they sailed over to Malizayatsky and found only corpses, which had been picked by the birds. Everyone was there. No one had escaped. So who now is going to seek out those guilty in the 60s of our great century? Anyway, Zarin, too, was soon removed from his post for liberalism, and it seems he got 10 years himself. From the end of the '20s, the face of the Solovetsky camp changed. From a silent trap for the doomed KRs, it was transformed increasingly into the then new, but to us old, species of generalized ITL, or corrective labor camp. The number of especially dangerous criminals from among the workers multiplied rapidly in the nation, and they herded the non-political offenders and hoodlums to Solovki. Both veteran thieves and beginning thieves landed on Solovki. a big wave of women, thieves, and prostitutes poured in. And when they encountered each other at the Chem transit camp, the women thieves yelled at the prostitutes, "We may steal, but we don't sell ourselves." And the prostitutes shouted back, "We sell what belongs to us, not stolen goods." The fact of the matter was that a war against prostitution had been proclaimed throughout the country, not in the newspapers, of course. And so they rounded them all up in all the big cities and pasted a standard 3 years on all of them and drove many of them to Solovki. In theory, it was quite clear that honest labor would swiftly reform them. However, for some reason, they clung stubbornly to their socially humiliating profession, and while en route, they asked to be allowed to wash floors in the convoy's guards' barracks and seduce the Red Army men, subverting the statutes of the convoy service. And they made friends just as easily with the jailers, not for free, of course. They arranged things even better for themselves on Solovki, which was so starved for women. They were allotted the best rooms in the living quarters, and every day new clothes and gifts were brought them. And the so-called nuns and the other KR women earned money by working for them, embroidering their underthings. And on completion of their terms, rich as never before, with suitcases full of silks, they returned home to begin an honest life. And the thieves spent their time playing cards, and the women thieves found it useful to bear children on Solovki. There were no nurseries, and by having a child, they could get themselves released from work for their whole short term. The KR women who preceded them had refused to take this way out. On March the 12th, 1929, the first group of juveniles arrived at Solovki, and from then on they kept sending and sending them, all of them under 16. At first they were quartered in the children's colony near the Kremlin with those same showpiece cots and mattresses. They hid their government-issue clothing and shouted that they had nothing to go out to work in. And then they, too, were sent off to logging, from which they fled, switching all their names and their terms, and they had to be caught and thereupon sorted out all over again. With the arrival of a socially healthy contingent of prisoners, the cultural and educational section came to life. They campaigned for the liquidation of illiteracy, but the thieves had not the slightest problem in telling the difference between clubs and hearts. They posted a slogan, "A prisoner is an active participant in socialist construction," and they even thought up a term for it too, reforging. It was here that this term was invented. In September 1930 came the appeal of the Central Committee to all workers for the development of socialist competition and the shock worker movement. And how could the prisoners not be included? If free people everywhere were being harnessed up, then wasn't it also necessary to put the prisoners between the shafts? From here on, our information comes not from living people, but from the book of the scholar-jurist Averbach. And therefore we suggest that the reader may wish to divide this information by 16, or maybe by 256. And sometimes it even needs to be taken in a reverse sense. In the autumn of 1930, there was created a Solovetsky staff for socialist competition and the shock worker movement. Inveterate repeaters, murderers, and cutthroats suddenly emerged in the role of economy-minded managers, skilled technical directors, and capable cultural workers. G. Andreev recalls, "They used to scream in one's face, 'Come across with your norm, you KR.' The thieves and bandits had no sooner read the appeal of the Central Committee then they threw away their knives and their playing cards and simply burned with thirst to create a commune. They wrote into the statute that the social origin of members must be either poor or middle-level peasant families or the working class. And it need be said that all the thieves were registered in the records and classification section as former workers, so that Shepchinsky's former slogan almost came true, 'Solovki for the workers and peasants.' And on no account would 58s be admitted. And the commune members also proposed that all their prison terms be added together and divided by their number so as to arrive at an average term, and that on its expiration they should all be freed simultaneously. But notwithstanding the communist character of this proposal, the Czechists considered it politically premature. The slogan of the Solovetsky commune was, 'Let us pay our debt to the working class.' And even better was the one, 'From us, everything, to us, nothing.' This particular slogan, which was fully mature, was probably worthy of all union dissemination. And here is the ferocious penalty they thought up to to punish members of the commune who were guilty of infractions, to forbid them to go out to work. Now, it would be quite hard to find a stiffer punishment for a thief than that. Nonetheless, the Solovetsky administration, which was not about to go as far as the cultural and educational officials, did not base its faith too heavily on the thieves' enthusiasm, but instead applied the Leninist principle, shock work, shock maintenance. What this meant was that the commune members were moved into separate barracks where they got softer bedding, warmer clothing, and were fed separately and better, at the expense of all the rest of the prisoners, of course. The commune members liked this very much, and for the purpose of keeping all their fellow members in the commune, they established the rule that there would be no more expulsions from it. This sort of commune was also very popular among non-commune members, and they all applied for admission to the commune. However, it was decided not to take them into the commune, but to create second, third, and fourth labor collectives, which would not have all those privileges. And in any case, the 58s were not accepted in any of the collectives, even though in the newspaper the most impudent of the hoodlums instructed the 58s. It's time, really it's time, to grasp that camp is a school for labor. And the reports were flown by plane to Gulag headquarters. Miracles at Solovki, a turbulent turning point in the attitude of the thieves. All the passion of the criminal world had been redirected into shock work, socialist competition, fulfillment of the production and financial plan. And in Gulag they were suitably astonished, and they broadcast the results of the experiment. And that is how Solovki began to live. Part of the camp was in the labor collectives, and their percentage of plan fulfillment had not simply risen, but doubled. And the cultural and educational section explained this by the influence of the collective. But we know what it was, common garden variety camp padding of worksheets, tukhta. I have been reproached with spelling this word incorrectly, and told that it should be written as it is correctly pronounced in thieves' jargon, tufta. For tukhta is the peasant's assimilation of it, just like kviodor for Fyodor. But I like it. Tukhta is somehow akin to the Russian language, while tufta is totally alien. The thieves brought it, but the whole Russian people learned it. So let it be tukhta. The other part of the camp, the unorganized part, yes, and also underfed and underdressed and engaged in the heaviest work, failed, as one can well understand, to fulfill its work norms. In February 1931, a conference of Solovetsky shock brigades decreed a broad wave of socialist competition to answer the new slander of the capitalists about forced labor in the USSR. In March, there were already 136 shock brigades, and suddenly in April, their general liquidation was decreed because a hostile class element had permeated the collectives for the purpose of causing them to disintegrate. Now, there's a riddle for you. The 58s were not allowed to cross the threshold, and so who was it who was causing them to disintegrate? What we have to understand is that the tukhta had been uncovered. They had eaten and drunk and made merry, they had counted things up, shed a few tears, and taken the whip to some so the rest would get moving. And the joyous hubbub gave way to the noiseless dispatch of the prisoner transports. The 58s were being sent from the Solovetsky mother Tuma to far-off fatal places to open up new camps there. Chapter 3. The archipelago metastasizes. Well, the archipelago did not develop on its own, but side by side with the whole country. As long as there was unemployment in the nation, there was no feverish demand for prisoner manpower, and arrests took place not as a means of mobilizing labor, but as a means of sweeping clean the road. But when the concept arose of stirring up the whole 180 million with an enormous mixing paddle, when the plan for super-industrialization was rejected in favor of the plan for super-super-super-industrialization, when the liquidation of the kulak was already foreseen along with the massive public works of the first five-year plan, on the eve of the year of the Great Fracture, the view of the archipelago and everything in the archipelago changed too. On March the 26th, 1928, the Council of People's Commissars, meaning it was still under the chairmanship of Rykov, conducted a review of the status of penal policy in the nation and of conditions in places of imprisonment. In regard to penal policy, it was admitted that it was inadequate, and it was decreed that harsh measures of repression should be applied to class enemies and hostile class elements, that the camp regimen should be made more severe, and that socially unstable elements should not be given terms at all. And, in addition, forced labor should be set up in such a way that the prisoner should not earn anything from his work, but that the state should derive economic profit from it. And to consider it necessary from now on to expand the capacity of labor colonies. In other words, putting it simply, it was proposed that more camps be prepared in anticipation of the abundant arrests planned. Trotsky also had foreseen this same economic necessity, except that he again proposed that a labor army be created by the compulsory drafting of people. The horseradish is no sweeter than the black radish. But whether out of a spirit of opposition to his eternal rival, or whether in order to cut people off more decisively from the possibility of complaint and hope of return, Stalin decided to process the labor army men through the prison machinery. Throughout the nation, unemployment was abolished, and the economic rationale for expansion of the camps appeared. Back in 1923, no more than 3,000 persons had been imprisoned on Solovki, and by 1930, there were already about 50,000, yes, and another 30,000 in Chem. In 1928, the Solovetsky cancer began to creep outward, first through Karelia on road-building projects, and in logging for export. Just as willingly, SLON began to sell its engineers. They went off without convoy to work in any northern locality, and their wages were credited to the camp. By 1929, SLON camp sites had already appeared at all points on the Murmansk Railroad, from Lodeynoye Pole to Tybola. From there, the movement continued along the Vologda Railroad, and so active was it that at Zvanka station it proved necessary to open up a SLON transport control center. By 1930, Svirag had already grown strong in Lodeynoye Pole and stood on its own legs, and in Kotlas-Kotlag had already been formed. In 1931, Belbatlag had been born, with its center in Medvezhyegorsk, which was destined over the next 2 years to bring glory to the archipelago for eternity, and on 5 continents. This was the official date, but in actual fact it had been there since 1930, though its organizational period had been kept secret to give the impression of rapid work, for bragging, and for history. Here, too, was Tukhta. And the malignant cells kept on creeping and creeping. They were blocked on one side by the sea and on the other by the Finnish border, but there was nothing to hinder the founding of a camp near Krasnaya Vishera in 1929. And the main thing was that all the paths to the east through the Russian north lay open and unobstructed. Very soon the Soroka-Kotlas road was reaching out. "We'll complete Soroka ahead of Sroka, ahead of term." The Solovetsky prisoners used to make fun of S. Alimov, who nonetheless stuck to his last and made his name as a poet and songwriter. Creeping on the northern Dvina River, the camp cells formed Sevdvinlag. Crossing it, they fearlessly marched on the Urals. By 1931, the Northern Urals Department of SLON was founded, which soon gave rise to the independent Solikamlag and Sevuralag. The Berezniki camp began the construction of a big chemical combine, which in its time was much publicized. In the summer of 1929, an expedition of unconvoyed prisoners was sent to the Chibyu River from Solovki, under the leadership of the geologist M. V. Ruschinski, in order to prospect for petroleum, which had been discovered there as far back as the 80s of the 19th century. The expedition was successful, and a camp was set up on the Ukhta, Ukhtlag. But it, too, did not stand still on its own spot, but quickly metastasized to the northeast, annexed the Pechora, and was transformed into Ukhtpechlag. Soon afterward, it had its Ukhta, Inta, Pechora, and Vorkuta sections, all of them the bases of great independent future camps. We are giving dates and places equal weight, but beg the reader to bear in mind that all this was gotten through questioning people and comparing, so there may be omissions and errors. The opening up of so expansive a roadless northern region as this required the building of a railroad from Kotlas via Kniaz Pogost and Ropcha to Vorkuta. This called forth the need for two more independent camps, which were railroad-building camps. Sevzhel Dorlag, on the sector from Kotlas to the Pechora River, and Pecholag, not to be confused with the industrial Ucht-Pechlag, on the sector from the Pechora River to Vorkuta. True, this railroad was under construction for a long time. Its Vim sector, from Knyaz Pogost to Ropcha, was ready for service in 1938, but the whole railroad was ready only at the end of 1942. And thus, from the depths of the tundra and the taiga, rose hundreds of new medium-sized and small islands. And on the march, in battle order, a new system of organization of the archipelago was created. Camp administrations, camp divisions, camps, OLPs, separate camps, KOLPs, commandant's camps, GOLPs, head camps, camp sectors, and these were the same as work parties and work sub-parties. And in the administrations, there were departments, and in the divisions, there were sections. 1. Production P. 2. Records and Classification, URCH. 3. Security Operations, again the third. And in contemporary dissertations, they wrote, the contours of educational institutions for individual undisciplined members of the classless society are taking shape ahead of time. In actual fact, when there are no more classes, there will be no more criminals. But somehow it takes your breath away just to think that tomorrow's society will be classless. And does that mean that no one will be imprisoned? Only individual, undisciplined members? Classless society is not without its lock-ups either. And so, all the northern portion of the archipelago sprang from Solovki, but not from there alone. In response to the Great Appeal, corrective labor camps, ITLs, and corrective labor colonies, ITKs, burst out in a rash throughout our whole great country. Every province acquired its own ITLs and ITKs. Millions of miles of barbed wire ran on and on, the strands crisscrossing one another and interweaving, their barbs twinkling gaily along railroads, highways, and around the outskirts of cities. And the peaked roofs of ugly camp watchtowers became the most dependable landmarks in our landscape. And it was only by a surprising concatenation of circumstances that they were not seen in either the canvases of our artists or in scenes in our films. As had been happening from the Civil War on, monastery buildings were intensively mobilized for camp needs, were ideally adapted for isolation by their very locations. The Boris and Gleb Monastery in Torzhok was put to use as a transit camp, still there today, while the Valdai Monastery was put to use for a colony of juveniles, across the lake from the future country house of Zhdanov. Nilova Hermitage on Stolpny Island in Lake Seliga became a camp. Sarovskaya Hermitage was used for the nest of Potmar camps, and there is no end to this enumeration. Camps arose in the Donbass, in the upper, middle, and lower Volga, in the central and southern Urals, in Transcaucasia, in central Kazakhstan, in central Asia, in Siberia, and in the Far East. It is officially reported that in 1932 the area devoted to agricultural corrective labor colonies in the Russian Republic alone was 625,000 acres, and in the Ukrainian Republic, 138,000. Estimating the average colony at 2,500 acres, we learn that at this time, without counting the other Soviet republics, there were already more than 300 such sekulzhi alone, in other words, the lowest grade and most privileged form of camp. The distribution of prisoners between near and distant camps was easily determined by a decree of the Central Executive Committee and the Council of People's Commissars of November the 6th, 1929. How they do manage to hit the anniversary dates of the revolution. The former strict isolation, detention, was abolished because it hindered creative labor. And it was ordained that those sentenced to terms of less than 3 years would be assigned to the general, near, places of imprisonment, while those sentenced to from 3 to 10 years would be sent to distant localities. Since the 58s never got less than 3 years, that meant that they all flocked to the north and to Siberia to open it up and to die. And the rest of us during those years were marching to the beat of drums. A stubborn legend persists in the archipelago to the effect that the camps were thought up by Frenkel. It seems to me that this fanciful idea, both unpatriotic and even insulting to the authorities, is quite sufficiently refuted by the preceding chapters. Even with the meagre means at our disposal, we succeeded, I hope, in showing the birth of camps for repression and labour back in 1918. Without any Frenkel whatsoever, they arrived at the conclusion that prisoners must not waste their time in moral contemplation. The purpose of Soviet corrective labour policy is not at all individual correction in its traditional meaning, but must labour, and at the same time must be given very severe, almost unbearable, work norms to achieve. Long before Frenkel, they already used to say, correction through labour. And as far back as Eichmann's, they had already understood this to mean destruction through labour. Yes, and not even contemporary dialectical thought processes were needed to arrive at the idea of using prisoners sentenced to heavy labour for work in remote, little settled areas. Back in 1890, in the Ministry of Railroads, they decided to use hard labour exiles in the Amur region for laying rails on the railroad. They simply forced the hard labour prisoners to work, while exiles and deportees were permitted to work at laying rails, and in return got a reduction in their terms by one-third or one-half. However, they preferred to get rid of their whole term all at once by escape. And from 1896 to 1900, work on the Lake Baikal shoreline sector of the Trans-Siberian was carried out by 1,500 hard labour prisoners and 2,500 compulsorily resettled exiles. However, generally speaking, the course of development in 19th century Russian hard labour was in just the reverse direction. Labour became ever less obligatory, withered away. By the 90s, even at Kari, hard labour camps had been transformed into places of passive detention, and work was no longer performed. By this time, too, the demands made on workers had been eased at Akatui, P. Yakubovich. So the use of hard labour prisoners on the Lake Baikal shoreline sector of the railroad was most likely a temporary necessity. Do we not observe here once again the two-horn principle, or that of a parabola, just as in the case of the long-term prisons, Part 1, Chapter 9, one prong of increasing leniency and one of increasing ferocity? Therefore, the idea was by no means new and not founded on progressive educational theories. Nonetheless, Frenkel really did become the nerve of the archipelago. He was one of those successful men of action whom history hungrily awaits and summons to itself. It would seem that there had been camps even before Frenkel, but they had not taken on that final and unified form which savours of perfection. Every genuine prophet arrives when he is most acutely needed. Frenkel arrived in the archipelago just at the beginning of the metastasis. Naftali Aronovich Frenkel, a Turkish Jew, was born in Constantinople. He graduated from the commercial institute there and took up the timber trade. He founded a firm in Mariupol and soon became a millionaire, the timber king of the Black Sea. He had his own steamers, and he even published his own newspaper in Mariupol called the Kopek, whose function was to slander and persecute his competitors. During World War I, Frenkel conducted some speculative arms deals through Gallipoli. In 1916, sensing the pending storm in Russia, he transferred his capital to Turkey even before the February Revolution, and in 1917 he himself went to Constantinople in pursuit of it. And he could have gone on living the sweetly exciting life of a merchant, and he would have known no bitter grief, and would not have turned into a legend. But some fateful force beckoned him to the Red Power. I have a personal hypothesis about this, which I will mention elsewhere. The rumour is unverified that in those years in Constantinople he became the resident Soviet intelligence agent, perhaps for ideological reasons, for it is otherwise difficult to see why he needed it. But it is a fact that in the NAP years he came to the USSR, and here, on secret instructions from the GPU, created, as if in his own name, a black market for the purchase of valuables and gold in return for Soviet paper rubles. This was a predecessor of the gold drive of the GPU and Torgsin. Business operators and manipulators remembered him very well indeed from the old days. They trusted him, and the gold flowed into the coffers of the GPU. The purchasing operation came to an end, and in gratitude, the GPU arrested him. Every wise man has enough of the simpleton in him. However, inexhaustible and holding no grudges, Frenkel, while still in the Lubyanka or on the way to Solovki, sent some sort of declaration to the top. Finding himself in a trap, he evidently decided to make a business analysis of this life, too. He was brought to Solovki in 1927, but was immediately separated from the prisoner transport, settled into a stone booth outside the bounds of the monastery itself, provided with an orderly to look after him, and permitted free movement about the island. We have already recalled that he became the chief of the economic section, the privilege of a free man, and expressed his famous thesis about using up the prisoner in the first 3 months. In 1928, he was already in Chem. There, he created a profitable auxiliary enterprise. He brought to Chem the leather which had been accumulated by the monks for decades and had been lying uselessly in the monastery warehouses. He recruited furriers and shoemakers from among the prisoners and supplied fashionable, high-quality footwear and leather goods directly to a special shop on Kuznetsky Most in Moscow. The GPU ran it and took the receipts, but the ladies who bought their shoes there didn't know that, and when they themselves were hauled off to the archipelago not long after, they never even remembered the shop. One day in 1929, an airplane flew from Moscow to get Frenkel and brought him to an appointment with Stalin. The best friend of prisoners and the best friend of the Czechists talked interestedly with Frenkel for 3 hours. The stenographic report of this conversation will never become public. There simply was none. But it is clear that Frenkel unfolded before the father of the people's dazzling prospects for constructing socialism through the use of prisoner labor. Much of the geography of the archipelago being described in the aftermath by my obedient pen, he sketched in bold strokes on the map of the Soviet Union to the accompaniment of the puffing of his interlocutor's pipe. It was Frenkel in person, apparently on that precise occasion, who proposed the all-embracing system of classification of camp prisoners into groups A, B, C, D, which left no leeway to the camp chiefs and even less to the prisoner. Everyone not engaged in providing essential services for the camp, B, not verified as being ill, C, and not undergoing correction in a punishment cell, D, must drag his workload, A, every day of his sentence. The world history of hard labor has never known such universality. It was Frenkel in person and in this very conversation who proposed renouncing the reactionary system of equality in feeding prisoners, and who outlined a unified system of redistribution of the meager food supplies for the whole archipelago, a scale for bread rations and a scale for hot food rations, which was adapted by him from the Eskimos, a fish on a pole held out in front of the running dog team. In addition, he proposed time-off sentence and release ahead of term as rewards for good work. But in this respect he was hardly original, for in 1890 in Sakhalin hard labor, Chekhov discovered both the one and the other. In all probability, the first experimental field was set up here too, the great Belomorstroy, the White Sea-Baltic Canal construction project, to which the enterprising foreign exchange and gold speculator would soon be appointed, not as chief of construction nor as chief of a camp either, but to the post especially dreamed up for him of works chief, the chief overseer of the labor battle. It is evident from his face how he brimmed with a vicious, human-hating animus. In the book on the Belomor Canal, the White Sea-Baltic Canal, wishing to laud Frenkel, one Soviet writer would soon describe him thus: the eyes of an interrogator and a prosecutor, the lips of a skeptic and a satirist. A man with enormous love of power and pride, for whom the main thing is unlimited power. If it is necessary for him to be feared, then let him be feared. He spoke harshly to the engineers, attempting to humiliate them. This last phrase seems to us a keystone to both the character and biography of Frenkel. By the start of the Belomorskoye, Frenkel had been freed. For construction of the Belomor Canal, he received the Order of Lenin and was named chief of construction of Bamlag, the Baikal-Amur mainline railroad, which was a name out of the future. While in the 30s, Bamlag was put to work adding a second track to the Trans-Siberian mainline on those sectors where there was none. And this was by no means the last item in the career of Naftali Frenkel, but it is more relevant to complete the account in the next chapter. The whole long history of the archipelago, about which it has fallen to me to write this homegrown, homemade book, has, in the course of half a century, found in the Soviet Union almost no expression whatever in the printed word. In this, a role was played by that same unfortunate happenstance by which camp watchtowers never got into scenes in films, nor into landscapes painted by our artists. But this was not true of the White Sea-Baltic Canal, nor of the Moscow-Volga Canal. There is a book about each at our disposal, and we can write this chapter at least on the basis of documentary and responsible source material. In diligently researched studies, before making use of a particular source, it is considered proper to characterize it. We shall do so. Here before us lies the volume, in format almost equal to the Holy Gospels, with the portrait of the demigod engraved in bas-relief on the cardboard covers. The book, entitled The White Sea-Baltic Stalin Canal, was issued by the State Publishing House in 1934 and dedicated by the authors to the 17th Congress of the Soviet Communist Party, and it was evidently published for the Congress. It is an extension of the Gorky project of Histories of Factories and Plants. Its editors were Maxim Gorky, I. L. Averbach, and S. G. Thirin. This last name is little known in literary circles, and we shall explain why. Semyon Thirin, notwithstanding his youth, was deputy chief of Gulag. Anguished by the vanity of authorship, he also wrote his own individual booklet about the Belomor Canal. The history of this book is as follows. On August the 17th, 1933, an outing of 120 writers took place aboard a steamer on the just-completed canal. D.P. Witkowski, a prisoner who was a construction superintendent on the canal, witnessed the way these people in white suits crowded on the deck during the steamer's passage through the locks, summoned prisoners from the area of the locks, where by this time there were more operational workers than construction workers, and in the presence of the canal chiefs, asked a prisoner whether he loved his canal and his work, and did he think that he had managed to reform here, and did the chiefs take enough interest in the welfare of the prisoners. There were many questions, all in this general vein, and all asked from shipboard to shore in the presence of the chiefs, and only while the steamer was passing through the locks. And after this outing, 84 of these writers somehow or other managed nonetheless to worm their way out of participating in Gorky's collective work, though perhaps they wrote their own admiring verses and essays, and the remaining 36 constituted an author's collective. By virtue of intensive work in the fall and winter of 1933, they created this unique book. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.